Welcome to the 27th Whistleblowers, the special initial coronavirus episode of the Whistleblowers. I'm Luke Decock. With me, John Clockerty, as always. And the last time we did this, John, on February 17th, the word coronavirus was only beginning to enter our vocabulary. And we would have done another podcast around, you know, the first week of March in the ACC tournament, but everything kind of exploded in our faces. So here we are on May 8th, finally catching up.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Certainly, it's not a good reason to be away, you know, for 2 months almost. But it's good to be back, and we figured out how to do this Zoom, and I'm glad you figured it out, and we have plenty of material to talk about.
Yeah, our first ever Zoom podcast. This is exciting technology, amazing computer magic that we're doing here. So yes, we're socially distanced and fully Zoomed.
You know,
and,
Luke, surprising. I talked to a couple guys just recently, and they asked, "How are you going to do your podcast?" And I said, "Zoom." And a lot of people use Zoom. In fact, one of the guys we're going to talk about that had the virus uses Zoom for his business. So
you're giving away all the secrets, John. Oh, I guess you're teasing people to keep listening. But yes, yeah. we have that to talk about. And we've all, I think, over the last 2 months learned how to use Zoom, and I've done several interviews with people that way.
How long are we gonna have to use Zoom?
You're asking the wrong gal, fella.
Ooh.
But let's start with a correction. That's always fun. Let's start with what we got wrong last time back 2.5 months ago. We were talking in our last podcast in episode 26 about coaches calling dead ball timeouts and how that had come out of the game. And then we had seen guys doing it, and neither one of us knew the rule, which is, you know, perfect for an officiating podcast. As it turns out, the rule currently is coaches can call dead ball timeouts in the final 2 minutes of regulation and overtime. So that's why we were seeing it, and we couldn't figure out. We had just, both of us somehow had missed that rule change. And,
it's good to clear it up, but it's not surprising because maybe for me, I should know that. But in the times that I was refereeing, the times that I was a supervisor, and the period of the 11 years that I did it, they were changing that timeout rule back and forth all the time. There were several changes in there, but referees do not like coaches calling timeout, obviously. It's been a heartburn for them, but that's the rule.
Yeah, and I've already screwed this up. We're however many minutes into this. Live ball timeouts, not dead ball timeouts. Live ball timeouts.
Live ball.
Have always been always done. It's like, you know, saying you can't touch the ball when it's not on the rim. Yes, live ball timeouts. We've already screwed this up. We're off to a great start. I hope everyone's really enjoying it.
It's okay.
Let's start with the big news of the week. There's actually a lot of things that are, piled up in our hiatus here. But the big news of the week is Mike Eads leaving the ACC, leaving the court entirely to become supervisor of officials for the SEC. And that's a huge loss for college basketball, not having him on the court. I think you and I would agree on that. Very good for the SEC, which will get someone who really understands the game and officiating. I understand this. Mike's 56. These supervisor jobs do not come open very often, Power 5 supervisor jobs. He's 3 years older than Brian Kersey was when Kersey, you know, walked away at the top of the game, walked from a Final Four straight into the ACC supervisor job. But I do think you miss a guy like Mike Eads, not just at the ACC level where he does a lot of work, the Big Ten being his other main conference, but nationally, where a guy who's worked a national title game, worked 3 Final Fours and 6 ACC title games. You told me this week, John, that you thought Mike was among the top 5 officials in the country.
Yes, and I think if you were to talk to maybe a large group of officials, coaches, maybe they saw Mike at the top of his game right now, and a guy that had, even though he's 56, that he could still continue at that level. for however many years. He always kept his weight down. He never carried a lot of weight. He's very athletic. He did suffer an injury year before last that cost him the 99% of the season. But, you know, I'm going to say that Mike thought it hard and talked to some people. He talked to Brian Kersey, through the process. And for all the reasons you just mentioned and some in your article, Luke, he's 56. Let's say he's really good for another 4 or 5 years. Those supervisors' jobs in the Power Five conferences don't come open all the time. So he saw that this is my opportunity now, and I need to make a hard decision, step off the floor, go into the supervising job, and have that for another, maybe I had it for 11 years. Kersey talks about 11 years is a good tenure. Mike, being 56, could do it for however long, maybe 15 years. But the point is, I was at the tail end of my career. I was 60 when I came off the floor. And at that point in time, you are less effective than you are at 55 or 56. It's a good time for Mike. I think he'll do a really good job. He's a calm individual. He's not one to get too emotional, either down or on the upside. But I thought Kersey's comment about we don't fill that spot real easy. We have to fill it with a staff of people, and that will be the case. But the ACC will be not as good staff wise than if Mike had not retired.
Does this open the door for some of the younger officials or less experienced, some cases older but less experienced officials who have been getting a look in the ACC recently? Obviously, Ron Gruber's kind of leapt that. I mean, he's worked a couple Final Fours now. He's kind of made that jump. But, you know, a guy like Bert Smith, who was in their little, you know, their little series that they did, the Serving the Stripes series the ACC did online, you know, a Bill Covington Jr. who saw more assignments last year. Does this open the door for guys like that? AJ Desai, you know, who's going to get a long look at a big opportunity at the ACC tournament this year. Open the door for guys like that to assume more responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, and they certainly they all like Mike, so they, you know, they're happy for Mike. But in another sense, it gives them an opportunity to get more games. And the guys you're talking about are the guys. It won't be the Ron Groovers or even Lee Cassell or Bert Smith. The guys that can benefit if they're up to it. Or the AJ DeSays, as you mentioned, and Tony Henderson, Billy Covington, they should get more assignments. You know, Mike's assignments are going to be split against the whole staff, but the Tony Henderson looks like he's ready to take it up another level. AJ DeSays, they both worked the ACC tournament. Billy Covington has worked it more than they have, but yeah, it's an opportunity. Everybody likes to use the word the next man up, and that's easy to say, but there are no Mike needs right now as the next man up, but they would be the group that would benefit the most.
But Mike Eads, when, you know, you've talked about it, when you took over the league in 2004, when did you,
2005,
yeah. You know, Mike Eads wasn't Mike Eads.
Yeah. Let me, you know, and I had talked to you a little bit. I think it was either that or, Mike Geats, he was a tier two official. Tier two is not a good way to present, but he was not in the in the top group of ACC officials.
The elite. But he wasn't elite. In the elite.
But he was really a good official, but he still had work to do. And he would say this, and Roger Ayers would say that. When I took the job, they were a tier two referees. But a credit to Mike, you know, he worked so hard at it, and he took criticism so openly and said, you know, what are my shortcomings, John? Where do I need to improve? And he did all of those things. And then he moved into a regular 15-game ACC conference schedule. Then he moved into a crew chief. Then he moved beyond a crew chief. He went to the NCAAs. He didn't go to the NCAAs right away. It took him some time. But then he had all the ingredients to make himself an elite referee. It took some time. Some officials, Luke, can go to one step to the next step and then get stalled out on that last step or two. Mike, that didn't happen with Mike. Mike just kept getting better. And, you know, he has some challenges now. He's going to be on training wheels as this supervisor's job. But he'll figure it out. He'll figure out, you know, what referees – that he needs to coach and mentor like I did, and he'll do that. And also, you know, maybe how to deal with coaches that aren't happy. All of those are learning experiences. But if he handles the supervisor's job like he did, his progress moving up the ladder in officiating, he'll do a really good job. I think he's got a good personality for it.
What do you think will be on his to-do list in the SEC? That's a conference that lately has had a lot of coaches complaining about officiating. You know, Cal has been pretty vocal. There were some numbers thrown around that more fouls were called in the SEC conference games than other conferences last winter, some analysis like that. And, you know, we've talked about some coaches being pretty vocal and getting fined for their criticism of officiating in the SEC just last season. What do you think Mike Eads is going to have to do? What are going to be the top items on his to-do list when he gets to Birmingham?
Yeah, I tell you, I think his biggest challenge, you kind of alluded to this when you talked to Brazo. His job is to recognize talent, whether it's through camps or other conferences, recognize talent, get them in the program, start developing, start moving those forward. He has to recruit guys back to the SEC that they lost and use them at every opportunity that's available. Open dates. What open dates can Lee Cassell give you, that Bert Smith can give you? Go to other conferences that have good referees. So you got to recruit. You got to develop. The problem will come in, and Mike is going to – it's going to take some time. He's going to have 16 referees for his tournament. And those referees that he's using during regular season are going to be refereeing other ACC other conferences. They won't be available. He does not have a strong staff to begin with. He has Doug Schaus, and he has Joe Lindsay, and he has Pat Adams. Three guys. I'm sure he maybe has some others, but he has three guys that I know are really good referees. And he can start getting leadership and building his staff around those three guys. Doug Schaus, the Final Four. Joe Lindsay's every bit as good. I don't know if he's ever been to the Final Four. And the other one, Pat Adams, has been to the Final Four. So he's got a couple Final Four referees to build around. He's got more. Joe Lindsay's every bit that good. But he doesn't have a good, strong, young staff. I think I had a pretty good situation when I came in. Not great, because I had Duke Etzel was phasing out, Larry Rose was phasing out, guys that you knew were phasing out. And but all those things, you gotta reach out to other supervisors and say, Brian Kersey, I need some help. I need some referees. And again, he's such a good guy, Mike. Everybody, look, try to look to help him out early on.
When you took the ACC job, were there guys you had worked with that you were like, oh yeah, I have games for these guys? And will Mike do the same thing with some of the guys he's worked with in the ACC, do you think?
I did. And like I said, every guy that Mike worked with, he got along with. There'll be guys, the other thing is, there'll be guys that maybe Mike doesn't feel real strong about, they're going to want to reach out and start filling their schedule with games in the SEC. And Mike may have a different opinion on them as a supervisor than he did working with them. Does that make sense, Luke? You know?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
There'll be those guys that say, oh boy, Mikey's got the job. I'm going to fill my schedule up with games in the SEC. I also had that I had some hard conversations with guys that I refereed with that came to me, oh, John, I can really help you. Well, I don't need your help. So he's got some challenges, but I think it's a good move for Mike. I'm happy for him. I did talk to him, and he's excited. He's very kind. He thanks me for helping, putting him in a position where he could succeed. And I said to him, Mike, you succeeded. I says, you wouldn't be where you were if you failed. So you did all the hard work. I did nothing. He did all the hard work.
Yeah, it's good to see people who have put in the work land in good spots. And as much as, you know, as someone who watches a lot of ACC basketball, I would prefer to have Mike Eads officiating those games than, you know, I mean, no offense to anyone, but you'd like to have good officials officiating games. And you're going to lose 15 or so games of Mike Eads. I think everyone's happy for a guy who has put in the time and is rewarded at the end. So
Brian Kersey, I talked to him also. He's got a couple guys that he thinks are ready to take the next step. I don't have those names right in front of me, but he's told me a couple guys that he feels like they need to get involved in conference games. And so I think, you know, the ACC, Luke, is always going to be in good shape in some respects because people want to referee in the ACC. You know, they'll be knocking the door there. They want to referee in a Power Five conference.
And I think, you know, apocryphally, if there's no real way to measure it, I think you can make the argument that the ACC staff, right now is as deep and strong as any of the conferences. I think maybe the Big 12 would have the strongest chaos. Big East, ACC are so intermixed now. I suppose you have to include the Big East in there too. And obviously everyone complains about every conference when you have to watch the same guys repeatedly. You know, no one's happy with their officials. But I think generally speaking, when you look at the ACC, you would put it there, in my opinion, with the Big East and Big 12 as the, you know, sort of the strongest, deepest is it. Maybe the, you know, the deepest is the way to put it.
Yeah. The year I stepped out, probably 06, Brian Kersey and Johnny Kell, the Big East supervisor, put the alliance together and they used cross ref. I was using a lot of Big East referees anyway, but they put in place scheduling together. It gives them so much more availability to the referees and the number of good referees. So it was a smart move by those two conferences.
All right, let's move on to our next subject. Very topical. There have been, to my knowledge, and maybe more to your knowledge, at least three college basketball officials who tested positive for the coronavirus in the days leading out of March in the conference tournaments that were canceled or in some cases completed. I know there was one Colonial official, and I'm sure there are others you know of. What can you tell us about those officials? How do you know how they were exposed? How they fared? Yeah. How hard it was on them?
Yes, I wanted to make sure that they were okay. So I talked to two of them this morning, but Keith Fogelman lives in North Raleigh.
Okay.
He got his, yes. And he was doing the Colonial Tournament. And on March 7th, actually it was March 6th, that he was in the tournament with a large group of referees who are, a lot of them are at different times inside the locker room, and then they go to dinner the night before the tournament. He felt no effects on the 7th of March. He got a high temperature, scratchy throat, no breathing problems, but he felt like something was wrong because he had some sweats, and he reached out to his doctor. They took him in and tested him. He did not have the flu. They took a test. He came back positive that he had the virus. But he said, John, the only thing they gave me was a Z-Pak for like the flu. That was no, and some cough medicine. I said, Keith, from the 7th, when did, he said, it lasted no more than 5 days. He said, John, I was clear the 5 days. I says, how about your immune system? Are you, do you feel like you're immune now? And he said, I do, because I'm giving blood to, for other people that have it. Yeah. And he just says, I had the virus, but I wasn't, it wasn't a real big setback. I was clean in 5 days. So there's another young man that worked for me in the Colonial and some ACC games. His name is Ron Tyberski. He lives in Western Pennsylvania. And Ron Tyberski was doing another tournament, and there was 14 referees or 9 referees. This was March 17th. And of the 14 referees at this tournament, 9 of them got the virus, which means that they were in the locker room together. They had dinner together. He doesn't know who passed it on to who, but 9 of the referees, I made that wrong. 5 of them got the virus, not 9. And let me go back. Keith Fogelman, I says, Keith, do you think you got it from one of the officials at the tournament? He said, no. He said, I think I got it from the hotel room. That was his take. He said, none of the referees, and he reached out to all of them because he had to. They wanted to know who he was in contact with. And right. He said, I did not. He said, none of those guys got it. I think I got it in the hotel. Now, Ron Tyberski had a bad experience. He is still dealing with it. And that was March 14th. And he's still dealing with it. I have followed him all throughout. And he could not turn the corner. It scared everybody because he wasn't getting better. Then they gave him the malaria drug, and he took the malaria drug along with a Z-Pak, and he said, John, I swear it has helped me. And that was what, and again, he's not 100%. They have him blowing into this ventilator tube that has a mouthpiece. You blow into it because his lungs are so empty that you have to exercise your lung, and it blows a little ball up through the tube. I don't know the exact name, but it's an exercise that he has to do. And when he first got it, he thought it was broken. And he says, what do you mean? And he says, well, I was blown and blown, and I couldn't move the little ball up through the vase. He said, I just couldn't do it. He said, I was sure it was wrong. And they told him, it's not wrong. You just got to keep trying. And now his lungs are getting stronger, and it looks like he's going to be, the doctors have told him his lungs will come back, but he was really in bad shape. And the last guy that I think you will recognize the name, Luke, is Mike Kitts. Yeah, Mike Kitts. Sure. Mike Kitts, yeah, he was a ACC, Big East, and then he became a supervisor. And I have not talked to Mike, but I, in talking to guys at not only talked to him, but was worried about him. My kids thought he was going to die. Hmm. And he was on a ventilator for a couple of weeks, I think. That's the word. I mean, yeah, he had it and couldn't breathe. Again, I can't give you the details because I haven't talked to Mike, but he worked for me in the ACC early on in my first two or three years before he became a supervisor. But he was in trouble. He's my age.
Yeah.
And the other two guys are younger, but Mike was my age, and he fought it hard, and they had to put him on a breathing ventilator. So that, you know, it's a scary thing, and the thing about, I guess, this virus is every person is the different level of effect that it has on them, ability. How one's more serious than the other.
Yeah.
And that's the three that I know of officials.
It's an interesting cross-section of how people's exposure to this virus can differ. It's possible, you know, especially Tversky and Mike Kitts with their connections to the Mac, you know, that they were both exposed at the same time or same place and had these very different reactions to it. And, you know, maybe one of those referees ends up with Keith Fogelman. You know, it's amazing knowing what we know now, that more referees weren't exposed, that more players and coaches were, and maybe they were and didn't have symptoms, but that haven't tested positive. I'm still convinced that the however many days it was I spent in Greensboro, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, with all those people from New York there, because Syracuse played, that I or other people there weren't exposed. Like I still suspect that there was COVID in the Greensboro Coliseum somewhere, and that we're lucky that more people there haven't been stricken with symptoms or tested positive. I don't know of any positive cases coming out of the ACC tournament. They may be out there. I just kind of assumed coming home that I had been exposed, and my wife and I basically for the next 2 weeks self-quarantined. We weren't 100% absolute about it. You know, we left the house to walk the dogs and whatnot, but we did not. You know, we tried to avoid leaving the house as much as possible,
just in case I had been
exposed. It's a scary thing. And these three guys were in a lot of the same situations that writers and supervisors are in throughout March.
Along those lines, Keith Fogelman, the first person we talked about, Keith, he believes, I talked to him noontime today, and he thinks his wife and son were infected, but they had a temperature, they felt bad, they had a cough, but they just fought it out, and he says, I feel like I'm certain that I gave it to them, but they dealt with it as they would have dealt with the flu. You know, they didn't get any worse, but both of them seem to be clear now. I'm glad they're all three of them are doing better, but I think that these places that have shoulder to shoulder people, Luke, are not a good place to be right now, you know.
Well, and there are at least two or three people, writers, who tested positive or believed that they had it after being at the Big East tournament in New York. So that was also kind of a hot spot. I don't know, you know, maybe no officials or players, but there were definitely media people and fans who believed that they caught it or know they caught it or suspect they caught it at the Big East tournament. So it was really a...
Oh, yeah.
Really
yeah.
A...
My son was... My son Tim was sitting at the table. He worked one game. He was scheduled to work the semifinals. The quarterfinals, he was sitting at the table. They canceled the game at halftime in the Big East.
Yeah. You know, it was such a crazy time. I mean, it was a crazy time in Greensboro. It was a crazy time in New York. It was a crazy time everywhere. I remember sitting on the floor at Greensboro Coliseum that Thursday. Florida State had just come out to warm up for a game none of us really believed would be played. And Dan Schulman of ESPN and I are sitting there scrolling on our phones. Every time we refresh Twitter, some other conference had canceled. I've made this joke a couple times. It was like, you may not remember this, but the movie Wall Street at the end, when they're all trying to get their money out of Blue Star and the traders are screaming, you know, another 10,000 out. And Dan's yelling over to me, the SEC out. And I'm like, the Big East is, they're playing, but they're pulling them off the floor.
The world's coming to an end.
It had the feel to it that things were just moving so fast. And then Florida State got pulled off the floor. And we found out later that Duke's president had basically called the league and said, we're not playing State today. So, we're done.
That was it, right?
And that pulled the plug. The ACC was headed that way anyway. I don't think they were going to let their game tip off the way the Big East did at 12:30. But Duke's president, Vincent Price, made the decision for them. But it's crazy to think now. We were prepared as of that Wednesday night, even with Rudy Gobert and Tom Hanks and everything that was happening. At that point, we were still prepared to play basketball on Thursday. And not only that, we were talking about, like, if NC State goes to Dayton, are we flying to Dayton? Are we driving to Dayton for an NCAA tournament that was going to be played without fans? That still seemed like a possibility at that point. And we were having the conversation. If NC State, gets sent to Spokane, do we want to go to Washington State in the middle of an outbreak? And then, obviously 12 hours later, the whole thing came crashing down. I think, it was just, it all happened so fast. But I'm not surprised, I guess is the point I'm very slowly circling back around to. Yeah. I'm not surprised that officials were exposed.
Yeah. My wife and I had 1 foot out the door, headed up to Greensboro, see the last couple of days of the tournament. And next thing you know, just like, they're canceling it, and Commissioner Swofford's on the floor canceling the tournament. Luke, there's not enough time in this podcast, but what will we be talking about this a month from now and 2 months from now, the same situation? I don't know how close we are to normalcy.
Not very close. I don't think. But we'll have plenty of time to talk about that if we want. And it'll be interesting to find out as this goes on, officials, media, players and coaches, how many were exposed and didn't know it. Because, who knew? Who knew? And then to find out that, it was probably a lot more endemic than we thought at the time. It's all a little crazy.
Yeah. I saw something along those lines in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was in Santa Clara, California. Might have been Santa Clara, but they thought maybe there was hundreds of people that were infected that didn't know it. Didn't have any idea. So
yeah. One other thing to come out of Greensboro, as long as we're on the subject, I was given as a gift by a parting gift by my former colleague Joe Giglio on his way out the door. Our last day together in Greensboro before he left the News and Observer, he plucked off the floor that Thursday morning or Wednesday night. The last game Wednesday night was North Carolina and Syracuse. Syracuse absolutely, stomping the Tar Heels in a game that was never close. And he plucked off the floor at some point an orange 3x3 cardboard card that had the officials' names written on it for Jim Boeheim, a little card he could stick in his suit coat jacket to know who it was he was yelling at. I find that very amusing, for one. But I imagine you have stories about coaches getting your name wrong, finding out who you are shortly before games. It says, men's basketball note. 1, Ted Valentine, 2, Bill Covington, 3, AJ Desai. So that was what was in Jim Boeheim's suit coat for the last game that anyone played in the ACC this year. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, the process is official or coaches, teams don't know who's going to referee their games until 1 hour before tip-off. And in the way I did it, and the way Kershey does it, you have administrative assistant, and we have all this written out you know, days ahead of time, who's going to work the games. But 1 hour before, your administrative assistant takes that card that you're talking about back to the coaches, to their dressing room, and they're to deliver it to the head coach. The head coach will see it. I can say that never once did it come back to me that they refused a player or didn't want it. But I had always asked my administrative assistant, what was the response when you handed it to them? Okay. Because at that point in time, you know, they really want the guys that they feel comfortable with. Well, Seth Greenberg, he never liked any of the referees that were assigned to his game. And I knew no matter who it was. So he looked at it, and one time I know that he just crumpled it up, threw it down, and in disgust. There was another coach, and you're going to have to help me. Who was the Boston College coach that before the guy there now?
Steve Donahue.
Steve. Good guy. Terrific guy. And his reaction, he would take it, and my administrative assistant says, John, I'm telling you, he never looked at the names. Never looked at it. Took your card and just threw it on the table or somewhere. He never looked at any of the names that I had ever given him. So it was not important to Steve who was refereeing the games. Then Coach Boeheim, he always liked certain guys a lot and other guys that he did not like. But as you could expect, you know, he would look at it and he would give you that, my administrator, you know, like if he has just tasted a sour lemon or something, you know, his face was crunch up.
Yes, but, we all know that. We all know that face.
You know that look, yeah. But they're because this referee and this coach is still active, you know that there's going to be some pushback you feel when this guy is assigned to a particular coach. And the only time I felt I knew that was coming is when the coach came out on the floor, caught my eye, and I knew he was not happy with me or the assignment.
I was about to ask how could that be, but then
I
have a
you
suspicion.
You can't see this, but he probably went, you know, something to that effect.
And it wasn't
raises it.
It wasn't Mark Gottfried and Carl Hess.
Carl Hess would not have worked Mark Gottfried in the tournament.
Oh, in the tournament. Okay.
Well,
I mean, but I mean, come on. I mean, it's the league. There are guys who are going to work the tournament. How can coaches complain about who gets their game in the tournament? They know it's going to be the same 14 guys or 12 guys, depending on the year. Don't they just have to deal with that?
Well, you know, when you say their complaint, none of them have ever reached out and says, you know, I got this and you knew I didn't like this guy and you put him in my game. That might happen afterwards. But they're preparing to take the floor. There was never a situation where it immediately came back to me, other than the one time the coach came out. He knows where I sat. He knew where I sat, and he looked at me, and, like, I have really screwed him on this assignment.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of sympathy for that guy. Like, you know who the referees are, you know who's going to work ACC tournament games. You got a 3-14 or whatever the number is, 3-15 chance, 3-12 chance of getting a guy. And the more you go in the tournament, you're almost guaranteed to have everybody. I don't know. That, yeah. That seems a little.
And actually, I know the Brazzo and Kersey feel the same way. Just what you just said, you know, you're going to get whoever we have, and they're ACC. You saw them during the regular season. You're going to see them during the tournament.
Well, deal with it, man. You know, I don't know. I mean, I understand that there are cases like the one we just briefly discussed yet again, where you keep a referee and a coach separated because there's issues or, you know, I get that. Like I don't necessarily agree with it. Like if a guy can't get along with a coach, should he be reffing in your league? But that's a discussion for another podcast. But I don't know, a coach looking over at you in a tournament game saying, oh no, I got so-and-so. Like, get a grip, man. Grow up. If that's your biggest problem, then your team must be pretty good.
You know, Luke, I hear you and I understand you, but you let these coaches have two tough losses against them with one referee who made calls. They are so sensitive to stuff like that, you know. Oh, I had this guy 13 times and I lost 11 of the 13
games.
I know.
I'm just saying.
I agree.
I can complain about that. But every, you know, John, no one ever had that problem with you.
That's not true. And I can say
that's not true.
It's not true. I tell you what, Nolan Richardson at Arkansas probably. I tried every possible thing and he was not happy, but John Guthrie was the supervisor and he said, you're going to go there and you're going to work. And when he goes into the tournament and you're going to work. And I had a couple championships game between Arkansas and Kentucky. They were, they were really hard games, but my supervisor, John Guthrie at that time says, that's not going to matter. You're going back there. You're going to referee the games. And I knew that Nolan Richardson probably had an agita when he saw me coming.
Were those tough teams to officiate because of the way they played?
Yes. Really hard. I mean, Arkansas was very good. It was, 40 minutes of hell? Is that what And then Pitino was at Kentucky, and he was had really good teams. And Coach Pitino was always of the mindset that I have enough good players that we are never going, you're never going to let up. And in other words, if you had two fouls in the first half, you were still going to play as hard as you can play and as aggressive, because I got another player that could, we can substitute for you if necessary. But yes, they were hard games. There was never any backing off in those games.
What else, John, would you like to talk about while we have this unexpected moment of
Luke,
pause?
And I mean this, and you know, there's a couple things that I try to follow that I they're so complex, it seems to me, in a couple of them, but now. Going forward, starting January of this coming year, 21, that name, image, and likeness that the NCAA is allowing student athletes to benefit on their names, image, and likeness. But it seems to me, and again, I'm the first to say I don't understand all the things that enter into it, but the NCAA wants to have Congress get involved in putting some safeguards along with their recommendation that they can go and get personal appearances and endorse products, do stuff on social media, but there's a limit. And the limits involves regulating agents and advisors. It seems that the deals made have to be reasonable deals. And Luke, this is an area that you're better at following than I would ever be. But that's just one thing. And in the way I feel about it is, the NCAA doesn't want to do any of these things, but they're forced into it because of states setting their own rules and saying, you know, the state of California, we're gonna let the players benefit from their name and so forth. So they've twisted they put the NCAA with their backs to the wall that they have to do something. But maybe you could jump in here and tell us what your thoughts.
Well, that is a lot to unpack, first of all. You hit on about seven different things I noted here. let's start at the beginning, because what the first thing you said isn't actually true. The NCAA has expressed a willingness to let athletes profit off their name, image, and likeness. They haven't actually said they can. The big announcement last week was a lot of big headlines without a ton of substance, because there's a lot of hurdles that are still set up for this to actually happen. And the last thing you said is absolutely correct. The NCAA has been pushed and pressured into this position by the states, starting with California, and could end up with as many as 30 or more that are pushing legislation that would allow student athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness rights like any other student on campus. You know, the idea that because you are a swimmer, you can't have a YouTube cooking channel that sells ads is the kind of ridiculousness that NIL is going to take care of. You know, if you are a violinist at Duke, you are allowed to play violin concerts and be paid for it without anyone kicking you out of school. If you are a basketball player at Duke who plays the violin, you are not allowed to have a violin concert for money. This will change that. Now, the actual specifics of it start to get really complicated, because athletes aren't allowed to use the school, won't be allowed to use the school logo. They won't be allowed to use the name of the school. They're basically going to have to do this on their own. And the really tricky part of what the NCAA is proposing, and the part that almost makes it impossible and unworkable, is deals are only going to be allowed to be fair market value, and the NCAA is somehow going to decide what the fair market value compensation is for a Tulsa offensive lineman doing a television commercial for a Tulsa Ford dealership, as opposed to Zion Williamson doing a commercial for a Toyota dealership in Durham. The idea that somebody can basically say, oh, this is the fair value for that, is ludicrous. It's absurd. It's the opposite of the free market, which is basically going to tell you what those things are worth. The NCAA is so paranoid about people using these things as recruiting inducements, when the reality is, whether they're fair market or not, they're going to be recruiting inducements. And what's wrong with that? If a kid has value, let him achieve that value. All right, we're getting sidetracked here. Let me finish correcting some of the things you said. This whole fair
market. You're not getting sidetracked. You're good, good, good.
This whole fair market value thing is an antitrust violation on the face of it. It's the definition of an antitrust violation.
Right.
So
right.
Part of the NCAA's pitch to Congress is, we're doing all this NIL stuff to get around all these state laws that are accumulating. We want you to pass a national law, which we write, of course, and we want an antitrust exemption. And I talked to Mark Walker, who's a Republican representative from North Carolina, who's pushed one of the three federal NIL bills. It's a bipartisan co-sponsored bill that he's trying to push through. And he said, look, because I don't think we're exactly in the business of handing out antitrust exemptions. That's like basically saying, John, I want to buy your house and you want to sell me your house, and we agree on that, and we've agreed on a price. Now I want you to give me all of the money, so I'm just going to pay you with your own money. Like, the idea of the NCAA is, we can do this if you give us an antitrust exemption. You know what? If Congress is in the business of handing out antitrust exemptions, a lot of people can do a lot of things and make a lot of money.
Yeah.
There's a reason those laws are in place, and very few antitrust exemptions exist. One of the ways around that is collective bargaining. If the NCAA were willing to bargain collectively with its athletes, but it's not, because that opens a Pandora's box of other things that athletes could collectively bargain for, and also, you know, would potentially make them employees and eligible for workers' compensation, which is the entire reason the term student athlete even exists. It was a legal dodge by Walter Byers to get out of paying workers' compensation to injured athletes. So this entire system is built on a con, basically. And the NCAA's NIL proposal is another con, basically a legal dodge to get around all these state laws. The reality is, And Mike Krzyzewski has said this most eloquently. Athletes have value before they get to college, and they have value after they leave college as professionals, you know, high-value athletes. There's just this one little phase of their career, is this 1 to 4 year phase of their careers where they have no value. And because they have no value, the market finds ways to get them value under the table or however. If you just let players get onto the free market, then you have a lot less under the table. So this basically takes a lot of what happens under the table and brings it above the table. That is a very long and confusing answer to your question. And I realize that, but this is a very,
but it's not, it's, that's what I said. It's issue. Very complicated. Yeah. It's a complicated issue, but for those that are frightened out there, I mean, I'm talking about the fans of schools. One thing that, and of course, look, I'm just touching the surface, that people that are frightened that the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer. What I saw on Yahoo Sports, a little podcast on Yahoo Sports, where Pat Ford says, it may even the playing field.
Yeah.
That.
How can the playing field get any less level, John? The four teams that were in the college football playoff have four of the top five recruiting classes. The rich are already getting richer. They don't need any help. What this will do, sorry, I don't want to step on Pat's toes here. I'm stealing his argument.
One of the points that was made, I thought made all the sense. You're here and you're being recruited by one of the big schools, but you're if you go to an Alabama, you may not get the benefit of the endorsements by being part of a large number, but if you go to a lesser school, you may benefit. And that was their argument. It may level the playing field. So not every top recruit's going to go into Alabama's going to get their numbers, but yeah, maybe. Yeah.
You know. Let's use that Tulsa example again. Let's say I'm a big left tackle from Tulsa. And normally I would be considering Oklahoma and Clemson and Ohio State and let's say those three. Well, let's say a group of auto dealers in Tulsa, your Eastern Oklahoma Ford dealers, are willing to pay me to do commercials, and it's a very large amount. Do I stay home and play for Tulsa where I can do a ton of endorsements? Or do I go and be the 12th man at Alabama, last guy in the deal team last to know, where I'm competing with all this other talent for whatever endorsements there are in the Tuscaloosa and greater Hoover market? Or do you go to Tulsa and be a big fish in a smaller pond? I think that will absolutely be a consideration. Here's the other thing it will do, which if they do this right, will be unbelievable. If Zion Williamson could have signed with Nike, he would still be at Duke. Think about that. He wanted to come back for a sophomore year. Now, a guy like RJ Barrett's gone. You know, he was a one-year guy. He probably wouldn't even have gone to college. And that's fine. Like, he had to go and he wanted to go to a place that his talents would shine and whatever. Zion was not the top prospect in the world coming out of high school. He was the top social media prospect because of his dunks. But he wanted to be part of a team at Duke. He wanted to go to college. And he would have gone back for a second year. And if he had a $10 million Nike deal, what's the risk then in going back to Duke? Between that and insurance, you know, he can basically get an NBA rookie contract out of it. It opens up the door. One, I think it will level the recruiting field in football especially, but also basketball. And I think it will encourage players who are on the fence, especially those who leave college for financial reasons. I'll throw another one at you. Trevor Lacy, you know, had a year of eligibility left at NC State when he turned pro. He knew he wasn't getting drafted. He was older. He'd transferred. He'd sat out a year. He was ready to get out in the real world and make some money. And if he had that year of eligibility left at NC State and he had the ability to make money off his name, image, and likeness rights, who says he couldn't have been doing ads for some NC State booster that would have paid him what he would have made playing in Algeria or wherever it was he went? And then NC State would have had a really good team with a, you know, sixth-year senior Trevor Lacy. So there's a lot of facets to this. And there's a lot of, the NCAA uses the term guardrails, which basically means we don't want anyone to actually make too much money that we would normally get. Like we want to hold control. And because they won't collective bargain and because they want to put these fair market restrictions on things, not only is this just a non-starter legally, you know, they're missing out on things like those NCAA football video games that people love, because they won't, as part of this proposal, allow the kind of group licensing that would let people make video games that people want. EA Sports wants to make the game. The players want to be in the game and would not demand a ridiculous amount of money. You know, they would want basically a percentage distributed across college football. The NCAA won't let it happen because it opens, again, another Pandora's box of legal issues if players are allowed to bargain collectively. So, you know, there's a lot of things the NCAA does that don't make sense to me. I do think in this case, it's a sense of self-preservation. The alleged collegiate model is under attack. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. Like you mentioned, fans who are fearful. You know, I don't think there's anything to be fearful of here. You know, the NCAA likes to make these legal arguments that if players get paid, you know, people won't watch college sports. Like, I may have missed it. I didn't stop watching the Olympics once Olympic athletes could get paid.
Right.
Like people have loyalty to their schools. They want their teams to recruit good players. They want their teams to win with those players. You know, there are plenty of fans who are okay with their schools giving money to players under the table. You know, why wouldn't you let a player, you know, make money off his Instagram account? You know, Cole Anthony, there's a study that says Cole Anthony could make $500,000 just doing Instagram ads last year. Who does that hurt? How does that destroy the collegiate experience? How is that any different than, you know, Natalie Portman going to Harvard? You know, she's a multimillionaire actress. You know, does that ruin the student experience at Harvard? You know, and here's the other thing. Oh, you know, if the quarterback gets all the money, the offensive line's going to be jealous. It's going to destroy the team chemistry. Kyler Murray had hundreds of thousands of dollars in his pocket from his baseball contract. He won the Heisman. How much did his offensive linemen hate him?
You know, everything that you, in the last 5 minutes that you pointed out, that the people do not understand all the complex things that go into name, image, and likeness. They don't think that far down the road. I mean, the first thing I would hear, oh, if you're going to allow players to get paid, then the people that have the most money, the Power Five conferences, are going to scoop everybody up. And never thought of anything that you just brought up. That would be the first thing I say. Oh, you know who's going to get rich in the basketball scene? It will be Duke. Well, Duke's getting those recruits anyway. You know, maybe it would level the playing field. But again, I think that NCAA, one of the things that I thought about is, let's leave it there.
All right, we're done.
We've hit that enough.
You have this internal clock, like any good referee and their 10-second clock. You have an amazing internal clock for realizing when this podcast is dragged on long enough.
Is it time?
It's time. I think it's time. Yeah, no. NIL is very complicated. There's a lot of propaganda around it. You know, I think some of what the NCAA is trying to do is genuinely good. And I think there are several initiatives. I wrote about one today about how the ACC had changed some of its transfer rules that were really stupid. And now that's been fixed. And the NCAA has done some of that too. Like, there are good things happening. But to your original point, it's not necessarily by choice. The NCAA is getting pushed into this corner by athletes who are filing lawsuits, like the O'Bannon lawsuit. It's being pushed by legislation. And there are going to be more lawsuits. There's going to be more legislation. The NCAA is trying to stay in control of this process, and it is losing control. So this is all going to change. This is all going to change.
Yeah.
You know, we can spend more
time. Well, Luke, what we need to do, because I had one more thing that I was going to ask
always, you always make such a good case for different things is the independent accountability resolution process. Okay. That, and followed by the independent resolution panel that has now been put in place by the NCAA this past August, where all these schools, not all, I can't say all, but a number of these schools that have been hit with penalties by the infraction committee are now going into the independent accountability resolution process, which is just another thing that the NCAA is doing that I think I have a fairly good handle on it because I read through it. But again, it's something we might want to talk about next time.
Yeah, that is so confusing, so complicated, and there's so much conflicting information out there about that. That is, again, probably a podcast on its own. But, you know, we figured out our technology here, so yeah. That's good. And we can do this again. And I think we've got a couple people who would be good for us to talk to. So I think we'll be back in a couple of weeks, maybe with a guest or two. There's certainly no basketball to discuss. So I think, as we've talked about offline, our plan for the pandemic version of this podcast is just to get some guests in and have some conversations and maybe take a step back from the day-to-day of college basketball and talk a little bit more about how officials got started, how their careers have progressed, what they think the issues in the game are, and bring on kind of a variety of voices. That's our plan anyway, and we'll see how that works out. But
I think that'll be easy. We can do that.
Yeah,
some guys that familiar names and so forth, and you know, let's hope we have a football and a basketball season.
Well, that's certainly something. Yeah, we can talk about, because I'm not sure that I'm not sure either of those is in the cards, at least under normal circumstances, what we would consider normal. So, excellent, John. I'm glad we were able to get your iPad hooked into the interwebs, and we'll try this again.
It's great. I'm glad we're back on, look forward to the next session.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, if you have questions, comments, concerns, things we got wrong, LDECOCK@newsobserver.com, @LukeDecock on Twitter, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much for listening.